Hello and welcome to Kitchen Curiosity. I'm your host, Radford Chancellor. And on this third episode, we're recording live in London and I'm joined by two industry guests. We're going to be discussing their careers, businesses, staffing, training and the skills shortage in the food service sector. And of course, we've got some questions from listeners. This episode is kindly sponsored by Grand Cuisine Academy. Now, my first guest is a highly experienced chef, a culinary expert, a chef director of Salon Culinaire and the vice president of the Craft Guild of Chefs and the Grand Cuisine Academy ambassador. He's a leading consultant in our sector. He was executive head chef at the Royal Garden Hotel for 25 years and received Lifetime Achievement Award and Education and Training Award, to mention a few of his accolades. Steve Monkley is undoubtedly the leading voice in education and training in the culinary world in the UK. And I'm honoured to have Steve here with me today in the studio. So, hi, Steve. Thank you for coming here and taking time out of your schedule. How are you?
It's a pleasure to be here. No, I'm great. I'm great. Looking forward to this.
Great. Fantastic. Well, you made us far. You found it anyway. Yeah, so that's
absolutely.
So, as many of you know, it's tradition in this series whereby the guest of the last episode asks the guest of the next episode the first question. So on the last episode, we had Sam Morgan, who's the CEO of the Open Restaurant Group. And his question to you was, how do we inspire a generation to become chefs? Because in his view, it's the greatest challenge the industry's got.
Well, I'm actually going to turn that round a little bit because I think we need to inspire their parents. I think where the industry suffers sometimes is the parents don't see chefing as a career for right. their children. They want them to be more academic and go down that route. And the pandemic didn't do us any good because obviously hospitality was one of the industries that got absolutely hammered during it. And parents then sort of got a bit of a negative feel about it. So my answer to his question is we really need to inspire the parents to talk about the industry to their children.
What, things like restaurants and going out and eating out, that sort of thing? Is that what?
Absolutely. I mean, just really cooking at home, you know, getting away from the fact that everything is about Michelin stars, that the industry is so much bigger than that and so much bigger than the television stars that they tend to see. And that, you know, we'll go on later to talk about my history, but to be a fantastic chef, you don't have to be that academically bright. It's a case of dealing with your senses. You know, yeah. We all cook with our senses. So I really feel that, you know, there's so much opportunity out there for young people, but their parents need to encourage them to go into this industry in the first place.
Definitely. And well, I've got some more questions. We're going to get into that. Yeah. So, Steve, you've got a rather impressive career record and you continue to be a leader in the culinary world with your different activities you're doing. Can you tell me a little bit about how you became a chef and a bit about your career?
Well, I think when you speak to lots of chefs, and you ask them, where did you get your inspiration from? Majority of us will say our mum or our dad, because that's where it starts. When you're a youngster, you're in the kitchen with your family. And my mum was a school cook in a 1,000 pupil senior school where they were cooking fresh food. Literally every day, the potatoes rolled up, you know, they went in the rumbler. And, you know, I spent many summer holidays or time off going and sort of hanging around the kitchen with her over there or on her apron string, right. You know, in our own home, learning how to bake. And she criticized my baking till the day she sadly I left home because it was never good enough. So
is it good enough now?
I wouldn't say my pastry side is, but she has given in that cooking savory stuff. She thoroughly enjoys it. So no, that's where my inspiration came. I was in the school that I went to. Boys didn't do home economics at the time, as it was called, okay. And they weren't allowed to. So I put a bit of a case up that I wanted to do it, and I managed to convince the headmaster to let me join home economics. So I did my last 2 years at school. There. Yeah. And I dragged a mate along with me, so I wasn't on my own. But no, that was fun. And from there, I just literally went into college. I mean, it was Ealing Technical College at the time. It's the University of West London now. I've stayed very close to them over many years and worked with them. But, you know, I all of a sudden found something that I just loved doing. I got into them kitchens. We were there for 8-10 hours a day at college at that point, and really found my niche in life. And that's where my career really started to kick off.
So you were working at the Royal Garden Hotel, which is a 5-star hotel in the heart of Kensington, just next to Kensington Palace, and you worked there 20
25 years.
Can you give us a glimpse of your life at the Royal Garden?
Yeah. Throughout my career, I tried different things, but I've always found that the hotel industry was where I was most comfortable because it gave you the opportunity to do so many different aspects of chefing. You weren't just concentrating on a very small a la carte menu for a set amount of guests. No 2 days were ever the same. You had a fantastic, you know, I had 60 chefs working for me.
Wow. How many bedrooms was that?
It was 400 bedrooms, but we had two restaurants. One was a Chinese one. I'll tell you about that in a second. We're banqueting for 400 in the main room and then 100 in another room and then smaller boardrooms around the building. One of the most important restaurants here was the staff canteen.
Right, okay.
300 people every day, breakfast, lunch and dinner. And if they weren't happy, boy, did I know about it.
Yeah. I imagine. Sure.
So no, I had a fantastic staff called Beatrice that used to mother them no end and they loved her cooking.
Did you have a chef dedicated to doing?
Yeah, a whole team. It was in a separate kitchen.
Oh, to do the staff?
To do the staff, yeah. Right, okay. It worked so much better. I had worked in operations where you expected the crew to actually muck in. And as much as you try and influence the fact that your staff are as important as your guests, when you're cooking for both, it's a bit more difficult. Having a dedicated team, which I really fought for when I first took over, actually worked perfectly.
Yeah, otherwise, always kind of like the forgotten.
That's it.
The forgotten entity. And then, yeah.
Yeah. And if you think about it in hospitality, if the guys that are out there at the front meeting the guests have had a crap meal, then they're not going to go up there with a smiley face on it. Whereas if we look after them in their downtime, they go back feeling refreshed and ready to go. So, you know, it was, and to be honest, throughout the time I was there, the senior management always supported it. We'd do all manner of things.
Yeah. What was the sort of typical guest you had? I mean, was the typical guest?
No, not really. We were very renowned for sport. I mean, we were hosts for both the touring rugby teams, international rugby teams and cricket teams. Okay. On a regular basis. Most of the people that played Chelsea stayed with us a lot. We also had a lot of the entertainment industry with us. We had a very late bar that used to stay open till 3-4 o'clock in the morning. Okay. And bands that were either playing at Wembley or at the Albert Hall would come back and they could just go and chill and be left alone. It was a very private area that, you know, unless you knew the hotel, you didn't know it was there.
Yeah.
And on many occasions, a great friend of mine, the barman up there, Louis, he would say they would just go and get a guitar and they'd sit there and they'd strum away and anybody in the bar got a free concert. So that, nice. So that
Did
was
you get
good.
Any royalty coming in the
Yes, yeah, yeah. No, over 25 years, we're bound to have had a few come through the door. And obviously, when she was alive, Princess Diana lived down the road and used the gym under the building.
Seriously?
Till the paparazzi found out, and then all of a sudden she was hassled out. But, but no, and that was quite a sad affair when we saw the flowers start to appear in Kensington Gardens.
Yeah.
You know, over the week, they just literally grew from the gates right through to Kensington High Street. It took them a week to clear them. There was that many in there.
Oh, yeah. An icon we'll never forget.
No, absolutely forget. Not. Absolutely not. But going back to my day, I mean, it changed every day, but I used to get in, I used to check the breakfast guys were okay and they were up and running because you can imagine, you know, 400 bedrooms, minimum of about 350 guests for breakfast. So it's one of your, to me, it's one of the most important meal periods of the day because it's the last thing a guest sees before they leave the building. If they've had a good stay but they have a lousy breakfast, then they're going to remember the lousy breakfast, nothing else. So
yeah,
checking on the breakfast guys, making sure they're good. If it's a day where I use the gym in the hotel, I'd grab an hour before we start down there.
I always think that in a hotel, breakfast is one of those meals. They either get it really right or it's just an absolute disaster.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, no, I agree entirely. And I managed to make sure that for all the years I was there, the hot food was a la carte. It came out of the kitchen. Weekends, we had a buffet because people wanted to graze. But Monday to Friday, businessmen wanted to come in, have a good breakfast. They wanted it hot. They wanted it freshly cooked and then leave. So, yeah. And I love working with the breakfast guys. It was great fun. They had some great characters. The head breakfast chef had actually come across from the Hilton Kensington with me and worked for me for 30 years.
Right. Okay.
So he knew exactly what I expected.
And what he wanted. Yeah.
So no, and then maybe we'd do the briefing in the morning. I might spend some time with the apprentices doing a bit of training onto a restaurant service at lunchtime, running the pass.
Yeah.
In the afternoon, maybe work on some menus with room service or something. You know, you got to remember in hotels, comfort food in the room is what people are looking for. They're looking for a club sandwich, a burger, a pizza. They're going to be watching the football on the TV and all they want. They don't want to come down to a restaurant. So, but it's got to be the best burger. It's got to be the best pizza and it's got to be delivered properly. So that takes, you know, you need to work on that and make sure we can deliver it.
Yeah.
In the evenings, if we had a function downstairs in the ballroom, I would always make sure that I was down there, making sure that everything was done well. And that's just one day. Every day was
different.
Every
day different, yeah.
Yeah.
All the different things that happen. Mm. So where do you see the UK in the world stage in terms of sort of culinary standards? You know, if we compare it to, say, the elegance of our French counterparts or the exotic flavours of, say, Pan-Asian, where do you see us sitting?
Oh, I think at the moment we're up there at the top for sure. I mean, the variety of what you can get in London, it as good as any major city in the world, and the quality of some of our chefs now is just outstanding.
Definitely.
I remember when I was coming up, I spent a year in Switzerland because at that point that was said to be the gastronomic capital of the world. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I had a marvelous time out there, and I worked with a gentleman called Franz Wild in Montreux, and he was just so passionate about. We all talk about produce now, but this was 30 years ago. This chef was already there.
Doing that.
He was already doing that. And again, he had a huge hotel, but he used to have a lot of the local suppliers come to his back door and sell their wares to him. The fishermen that caught the perch in the Lake Geneva would come with their catch of the day and he'd just give them a docket and they'd go and get their money from the cashier or during the apple season, they'd bring their apples down. It was just amazing. Amazing. And he just, you know, it's one of the first people that I ever kind of related to in my career that had more love for the produce and handled it like a baby all the time. If you saw any of the chefs doing anything that wasn't respect, then he literally went mad at them.
Okay. What would you say? I mean, if we're going out for a restaurant tonight, where would you book? What would be your like go-to? Where would you?
I've kind of gone. Chef says most of us get older, we go full circle. We've gone away from the real fine dining food to going back to sort of, a lot more restaurants that concentrate on specializing in certain things. So, I haven't got any one favorite restaurant. Every year I go to a mixture of different places. Mm. I don't tend to go back. We live outside London in Hertfordshire. So I kind of, have a variety of them. I am quite lucky in the respect that every year with the Craft Guild of Chefs, we have the newcomer of the year. So I get to go around all the four chosen new restaurants to eat in and to pick the winner. Okay. I have had experience of many different ones, but often it's the little ones that are outside of London that make a big difference. And one that always sticks in my mind is Pea's Pottage, which is out in Bury St. Edmunds. Just an amazing meal out there. We're going to Muse in York this year, which is a similar one. So I'm going to see what that's like, see whether that hits the mark against.
And I think we all sort of bang on and focus about London, don't we? But there's also a whole world outside London.
And there's so many chefs nowadays that are getting their own little places. They do the big thing. They work with all the big boys, but then they go off back to wherever they were brought up and start opening their own, and they can do exactly what they want to do.
True. Okay. Now, see, this is a question from one of the listeners, Fraser Jones. He's a director at AP Projects, and he asks you, if you were to go back to the start of your career, what's the single best piece of advice you give to your younger self?
What's the best bit of advice I give to my younger self? I may have well have travelled a bit more. In life, you kind of meet people at certain times, and I'd gone to Switzerland and done a year in Switzerland. I then started working for Marriott Hotels, and they had opportunities to give me working in different countries. I did a bit in Austria and I did a bit in Germany. And they then offered me some head chef positions around the world. But at the time I was married and we were starting to bring our family up.
Right.
And I think
traveling too much.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's so many chefs that are in broken relationships that they've been very selfish in their approach. I sort of looked at it from the point of view, I used to work 12, 14 hours a day. You know, I didn't want to go to a country where my family didn't know anybody or anything. But
so was the advice not to get married?
No, the advice wasn't not to get married. It's to get the traveling out the way before you meet the right person.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Because I could well have gone on sort of jaunting around and experiencing more countries, because I think the more in your repertoire and understanding of produce in other countries. Because now in London, you can get absolutely anything. Don't feel that any cuisine is not open to us, because they are. And all ingredients will be here somewhere in some form.
If we go back to the 80s and, you know, you couldn't get, well, half the things you can get now. I mean, I remember, I think I was like 18 before I'd seen a star fruit, you know, and then what was this thing that turned?
And then it tastes bloody awful because it wasn't ripe and it wasn't what a star fruit. I mean, we're only, you know, if you think about it, it's only over the last 5 years we actually get ripe avocados. You know, we always used to get them like bullets, didn't we? But we accepted that that was the way to eat them.
That was what it was, yeah.
Now we know what they really taste like.
A Salon Culinaire director. Essentially, it's, for people that don't know, it's the Olympics for cooking, I suppose, is a good analogy.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess you work with many extraordinary chefs, be judges, be competitors. Mm. Can you tell us how the competition works and any memorable dishes or menus that kind of stand out for you?
Yeah, I think the you're right, it's the Culinary Olympics for chefs, because really this is the big one within the UK for people to come and look at. Memorable Marts for me, I took over about 8 years ago, and the one thing that I insisted on reintroducing was the skills theatre, which is for young people to come along and cut their teeth in competitions. Now, people say, oh, you don't need competitions. You're right. You don't necessarily need them. But what it does focus young people on is actually practicing a skill to the extent that they are really good at it. Yeah. And that's what the skills theatre did. So this was a new element to the programme that never used to be there. The big showcase piece is the live theatre, where we've got 8 to 10 stations of chefs cooking against the clock. At the exhibition hall. And my role as salon director is to make sure that, A, the kitchens are equipped with modern technology, because we always used to have the old gas stoves where you open the doors and the heat came out the oven and nothing ever worked, sort of thing. And having gas was always a bit of a safety issue. So my role really is to have brought it on, reinvigorated it, looked at the competitions that we actually have in the schedule and modernized some of them, because, you know, we definitely, chefs nowadays are moving in the trends, and a lot more sort of, I would say casual dining, but casual dining to a very high standard, more so than necessarily everything being fine dining. And then that opens the competition theatre up to a wider audience, rather than just going for your chefs that think that it's a Picasso on a plate that's going to win them a gold medal.
Right, okay. So it's more about the components, the detail within the dish.
And the taste. I mean, ultimately, every single judge, you go into any judging room, and the first thing they'll say is, my God, that tasted fabulous. You know, and it doesn't matter whether it's a stew on a plate or something. I always say to everybody, if a judge goes back for a second tasting, then that dish is good. If the judge just pushes it around and walks away, taste that good.
No gold for me today.
Memorable, it's a shame. Basically, we lost something called Parada Chefs, which was restaurants, a team coming in and running a restaurant for 70 in a day. Okay. So basically, they started from scratch. They got everything done. And they served 70 covers.
At the exhibition. Why was that?
Cost. Cost. It just really got down to the fact where it was so expensive to run it.
And then set up.
And we got the national teams competing in that. We had people like the Ritz, people like people like Dorchester or the House of Commons, they'd all put teams in, along with sometimes we even got the lecturers of colleges. So I remember Westminster Kingsway, the actual lecturers put a team together to show that they still could do it as well. So, so no, that was real good fun on that one. Now we've got, we introduced a couple of years ago, a double header for apprentices where they'll do a skills test in the skills theatre where there's no cooking. It's just a stainless steel table and you come in and do a butchery or a fishmongery task.
Yeah.
And then you'll go across to the hot kitchen in the afternoon with whatever you've done and I'll give you a basket of mystery ingredients and they make a dish.
Well, and somebody's, how long they got to
they've
make
They've got 45 minutes then to,
wow, that's
to
a
knock
lot
out a dish. And the most popular competition of all is we have a senior mystery basket where it's a two-man team and they've got an hour.
Okay, highly qualified chefs.
Whoever. It's a two-man team. They literally get 5 o'clock the night before the ingredients emailed to them. They're the first competition in the morning at 8 o'clock and we normally get twice as many teams as we can take enter it. So I have the horrible job of culling some of them out.
Yeah. And then someone's got to judge it as well. Okay. So the final question is something that I pose to all my chef guests. You're hosting a dinner party for three people and yourself. You can go along if you want. Which three famous people, dead or alive, would you going to invite? And what's the menu going to be and why?
I thought long and hard about this because you obviously give us the heads up on the question because I think trying to think on the spot would actually not work. So
I could go disastrously wrong.
So it's interesting because I thought politicians, I thought, nah, I wouldn't want to sit with politicians for dinner. I'm more into sport and cooking and fun. So the first person I'd put on my list, and a lot of people may or may not know him, is a gentleman called Gary Jones, who run the Manoir at Quatre Saisons.
Okay.
I've never worked with Gary, but I've done lots of things with him over my career, and I just never met a truer gentleman and somebody that is so passionate about our industry and talking to young people and making people feel welcome, making them feel important, you know. And he was, you know, obviously Raymond Blanc's name's across the door, but for 20 plus years, Gary was the man that made it happen.
Okay.
And I just respect him immensely for that. And just a lovely chap.
Right. Okay.
Going down the sporting route, I'm a big rugby fan. So Johnny Wilkinson is one of my heroes. Read the book, listened to him so many times talk about how that World Cup went, what they went through to get there, how he suffered with some mental issues in the respect of getting in the right position, working with psychologists and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But to me, again, just an amazing, amazing man.
Yeah.
And then on the comedy side, the type of comedy that really tickles me was Jasper Carrot. He takes every day.
The name
things.
You don't hear every day.
No, it's
days.
Not. We are a little bit older, so, but, you know, there are people.
Some of our listeners might have to Google that.
there are people that have sort of, you know, it's Peter Kay's this world now, carried on that sense of humor, where they'll take an everyday thing that all of us do, and it's funny, but told by somebody like Jasper Carrot, I just think he'd have us in stitches all night.
And what are they going to eat? What's the menu?
Are
you cooking it? Are you taking them? I mean, some people are copped out and just taking them out. But
no, I like to cook and, I'm one of these people that likes to cook and join them because I like to have a good, whenever I do a dinner party, it's about 3 or 4 hours because we have great big spaces in between so that we can enjoy it. And it's predominantly sort of simple food. It's nothing too fancy. I love pasta. So there's normally a starter of either a pasta or a fish dish. My favorite food to cook is fish. And then slow braised meats. I mean, to me, you can't beat it because it doesn't go wrong. You know, if you're carrying on talking and you're waiting another half an hour.
We've got a half bottle of wine or something. It's going to hold on for you.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then I'm not a great dessert person, but a bit of lemon tart or something like that would just, you know, cleanse the palate and finish the meal off. But I think the conversation would be more important than the food in this occasion with them guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that sounds like a great menu. Well, thank you, Steve, for taking the time to be part of this podcast and giving the listeners insight into your career and the subjects we talked about. We're going to take a short break now and we're joined by our next guest and then we'll come back to you and be discussing about training and skills shortage in the food service market.
Grand Cuisine is a leading UK supplier of professional cooking appliances from some of the most established manufacturers in the market. Using vast industry knowledge and 50 years of industry experience, Grand Cuisine have carefully selected ranges, including specially crafted bespoke cooking suites by Athanor and modular ranges for Moreno, helping you to create a truly exceptional cooking environment. To learn more, go to grandcuisine.co.uk.
The Grand Cuisine Academy was launched in 2019 by Grand Cuisine. Their aim was to give back something to the hospitality sector by supporting chefs, lecturers and students with a free online resource that they can access whether at college, home or even in the kitchen. I'm joined now by the founder of Grand Cuisine Academy and the managing director of Grand Cuisine, Stephen Hobbs. Stephen has over 30 years' experience in the food service industry, as well as design, supply and technical sales of food service equipment. He's the immediate past chair of the FEA, Food Service Equipment Association, and has operated extensively in the UK, Europe, Middle East, Asia, supplying cooking solutions to some of the most prestigious chefs and kitchens in the world. Stephen, welcome to the show. How are you?
Yeah, great. Thank you, Rad. Amazing to be here. Very much looking forward to it, like Chef Monkley.
Stephen, so tell us about Grand Cuisine Academy. You know, why have you invested so much time and money, blood, sweat and tears into this not-for-profit or venture?
I don't know really where to start on that. All I can look back on is when I first started in this career 30 years or so ago, almost the third or fourth question that I was asked by chefs when I went to see them was, do you know anyone who wants a job?
Right.
That's obviously got subsequently more challenging over time, to the point now that it's almost the first question you're asked. And it really started with a situation with my daughter, inherited daughter, who's now 21, who 5 or 6 years ago was doing her careers advice at school. And as a proud parent, you get dragged along to careers advice days.
Yeah.
And wandered around, and there's UK Accountancy Service there, there's Network Rail there, there's all the services, Army, Navy, Air Force, but nobody from hospitality.
Really?
And I got chatting to her head of school at that stage and just saying, you know, well, look, Poppy's very interested. She might want to do this, she might want to do that. I said, but just out of interest, why not hospitality? And I got two points that came back from that. One was, well, we asked a couple of hotels, restaurants, college to come along, but they couldn't find the time.
Right. Okay.
And secondly, the comment was, and it's not really a career that we want our girls to go into.
Wow.
And I was absolutely staggered to think that this is the state of UK education. At which point I then pointed out to a head of year teacher that I'd had a pretty amazing career, traveled the world, eaten some of the most amazing restaurants, and been paid to do it.
Yeah.
And that's really how it started. That then got me in a conversation with our local college, Milton Keynes College, met an amazing lady there by the name of Maria Bowness, and then started to massively understand the problems that the education sector finds itself, especially in hospitality, of funding those courses. And there are principals, heads of colleges or whatever, that are looking at college courses. And in essence saying, well, you know, it's very expensive to run a hospitality course. You know, there's lots of materials needed. There's lots of time. There's energy issues. There's equipment issues, blah, 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 blah. We can run a degree course in, I don't know, business management or whatever it might be, which means we've got to provide a desk and that's it. Individuals provide their laptop, get on with it. It's much easier, much less stress, much less aggravation. So that then just got this whole process starting, just literally with a local college of how, what can we do to help? Because if we're not helping them to help turn the students out, those students aren't going to get into the marketplace. Those students aren't going to develop their careers. their students aren't going to get to senior positions in life, like Chef Monkley.
Yeah.
And those individuals aren't then going to be making decisions on buying equipment, which has a direct impact on my business.
Yeah.
And to be quite honest, that was literally how we started.
Okay. So going on to Grand Cuisine now, who are a leading supplier of professional cooking equipment, can you give us a bit of insight into Grand Cuisine's business, what you do, basically?
So basically, we are an independent UK-based business. In essence, we act as the manufacturer's representative here in the UK market.
Yeah.
We work on behalf of two brands, one which is based in France, Athanor, which is a manufacturer of bespoke cooking suites, and one which is based in Italy, which is manufactured by the name of Moreno, which is involved in the modular prime cooking. So we're only involved in the sale and development of that product or that prime cooking.
So you import these products from the UK?
Yeah. So obviously post Brexit, you know, we had free movement of people, free movement of trade, free movement of goods, which meant that as a manufacturer, you didn't have to be based in the UK. You didn't have to have a representation in the UK.
You could literally bring it in.
Yeah, pick a phone up, pay somebody some euros and they would send it to you. Obviously, post-Brexit, that has massively changed. And now, you know, anyone that's importing product into the UK is legally responsible for that product, is legally responsible for placing on the market, is legally responsible for its product liability, its public liabilities, and also then responsible for it once it reaches the end of its life cycle, i.e. what happens to it, its reprocessing.
Yeah.
So in essence, that's what we do as a business, but we were doing that pre-Brexit. Just predominantly acting more.
I mean, fundamentally, you're effectively a manufacturer, I suppose.
Or the manufacturer's representative. Yes. Yeah.
And you selling through to distributors.
So
that's what.
Yeah. So our approach to our development of the market is very much what I term one of direct sale, but indirect supply. So it's our responsibility to go and get our products sold to the consultant, the chef, the distributor, the dealer, whoever's specifying the project.
Yeah.
And then in essence, make sure that it's supplied back through the distribution chain. Because as I always say, you know, the cooking element is only part of a much bigger project. You know, when you're looking at a major refurbishment, be it of hotels, hospitals, colleges, wherever, you know, there's a whole raft of specialist manufacturers that are looking after refrigeration, dishwashing, ventilation, cooking, stainless steel fabrication and everything else. So yeah, our bit is just the cooker in the middle of the kitchen.
Goes through the distributor and then they install, they install it?
It depends project by project. Some projects we are a supply and deliver only, and the third-party distributors then making the installation with their engineering team. Some projects we're on a supply design, manufacture, supply, deliver, and install basis. It really depends on the complexity of the job and what's involved with it.
Okay. I mean, why should someone buy from Grand Cuisine, for instance, rather than somebody else? And it's I know the answer to that. I've dealt with you, so I know the customer service, but
I say it in the nicest sense. You know, we're not a big organization. You know, there's only five of us in the company. We're not a massive organization. It's great with my involvement with the FEA to be able to sit around the table with some major manufacturers. Mm. I think at the end of the day, a lot of client decisions about purchasing comes down to personalities, you know, definitely, whether it's us, whether it's, you know, our competitors. It's about the relationship you have with the individual. And it's also about the ongoing relationship. And I've always said this is that, you know, selling the kit in inverted commas is the easy bit. It's the post-sales sale aspect that's difficult. And I'm lucky enough to have worked with Steve Monkley over many, many years. Still puts the fear of God into me because I remember meeting him as a young 20-something year old when he was the, I believe at the time, head chef or executive chef at the Hilton on Kensington.
Right.
And from there, we've obviously, you know, always kept in contact. But I've been lucky enough that I worked with Steve. I think it was one of my Bonnet days when we put a Bonnet stove in there. And then obviously when Steve then moved to the Royal Garden when he first there, put a Bonnet stove in there. And then when that came up for refurbishment, what, 20 years later, we put an Athanor stove in there. So that relationship is not necessarily... Okay, product is a big thing and the heritage of the product, but it's also very much the situation, the relationship
and the support and the backup. And,
you know, and I say it in the nicest sense, you know, if ever we had an issue, you know, Steve would ring me and he knows that you can't resolve it there and then. He understands that, you know, my A, B, C, what isn't working. But what he wants to do is he wants to know that somebody's going to take responsibility for that problem.
Sort it out.
Exactly. You know, and it might well be, look, chef, I can't get an engineer in there till Monday, Tuesday, next Thursday, a week on Friday. Mm. But he knew that when we did come, you know, it would be sorted. And I think that's just the relationship you need with any operator.
Definitely.
You know, it's a very, you know, they're under massive pressure and all they want to know is somebody's taking that
responsibility and get it fixed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, get it running. So just thinking about your role within the Food Service Equipment Association. So for people that don't know, they're the association predominantly for manufacturers. They're the leading association in our sector, really. And you were the chair and so the immediate past chair. And also think about your role as managing director. If you're going to give like one piece of advice to someone starting a business in food service equipment, what would that be?
That's a tough one to answer because if I was to go back and look at myself 20 years ago, I would never have thought I was going to run my own organization. Yeah. It was just purely the right place, the right time, the right opportunity. And I say this in the most cynical of senses that at that stage, I was in my mid-30s. Mm-hmm. I honestly thought there's an opportunity. If I don't take it now, I'll never take it. If it's an unmitigating disaster in 3 years' time, all I'll have done is lost a little bit of time and a little bit of money. And at that stage, I'll still be in my 30s and not over that magic 40 line as it was then, and therefore still will be employable. Mm. So literally an opportunity came along, right place, right time, had a very supportive partner at the time who was, well, if that's what you want to do, yeah, we can make some sacrifices and get on with it. And that was literally it. And a lot of hard work, a lot of energy. I would actively encourage anyone, if they think they've got an idea to do it, they think they've got the right product, they're willing to take a bit of a risk, just do it. Just do it. I mean, what's the worst could happen?
Yeah,
you'll always find a job in this industry.
No, you're right as well. The UK is entrepreneurial, isn't it? So yeah, definitely just get out there and do it. If you're thinking about it, don't hang around.
Yeah.
So what's next for the Grand Cuisine Academy? Can you share any innovation? What's in the pipeline? Anything you're particularly proud of that's coming up the Academy?
I say this in the nicest sense, but for me, I'm not necessarily involved with it very much on a day-to-day basis. It's very much, and we'll talk about it obviously a little bit more, but it's very much sort of, you know, Steve has quite openly taken this challenge on to develop it along with a guy who sits very much in the background, who's quite a bit of an unsung individual. I remember Simon Smith at Dunk Inc. Name check for you, Simon. So, you know, he's very much helping Steve to develop it. But certainly for me, I mean, you know, when I look at where we started with this in 2019, and what you have to remember is I sometimes say this, that if we were a year earlier, I think we'd be much further down the line with it, because the whole pandemic situation, then learning online, very much came about. But when I look at where we are today and having noted that sort of 18-month, two-year period of not doing much, you know, I'm incredibly proud to think that we've got, what, over 800 members on the Academy website now. Okay. We have more than 900 subscribers on YouTube, and I never thought we'd be a YouTube sensation. I don't know whether 900 is a YouTube sensation.
It's a lot.
But it's a fair bit. You know, we have 114 videos online. We have 15 other videos that are currently in being edited and production and whatever. I know Steve has a diary booked for the next 3 months of colleges that he wants to get to to present the Academy to, and obviously work with the chef lecturers on that side. You know, when I look at, you know, what we've achieved, you know, one of the videos we have on there has received more than 21,000 views.
Wow.
On jardiniere cut of a vegetable. So it's obviously being used.
It's a good resource. Yeah.
And what I'm finding more now is that initial period of getting the stone rolling, or the ball rolling as it were, is now really starting to bring, you know, benefits.
And then word of mouth and people talking, and it will just grow and grow.
And to be fair, now what we're finding is employers coming to us and wanting to use it as part of their development and apprenticeship schemes and whatever. And that's just an amazing thing that I never thought we'd have those opportunities to come along. Yeah. So for me, I say it will never be a finished piece of work. There'll always be something else we've got to add.
Different.
Yeah, there's always new techniques, new methods. you know, and then there's the whole raft of, oh, well, can you take it into front of house? Can you take it into, you know, different areas? So I think we've sort of created this beast, and yeah, going forward, all we need to do is, and big plug now, is just keep selling more cookers to keep funding the activity of the academy.
And if people want to find the Grand Cuisine Academy, do they just literally Google that, or they got, is it, what's the?
academy.grandcuisine.co.uk. That's perfect. Literally it.
There we go. So now Steve rejoins Stephen, and for the purpose of this podcast, this part of the show, Steve Monkley remains as Steve, and Steve Hobbs will be called Stephen, just to throw a spanner in the works for the listeners. Okay, James, to kick us off with the $64 million question, and let's drive straight into a prominent topic, the skills shortage in the hospitality sector. What's your thoughts? Either of you kick us off.
Well, my thoughts are, until the funding for the colleges gets a little bit more taken notice of, we're going to carry on. Because, you know, when I was talking about my training at Ealing Technical College, I was there for 40 hours plus a week.
Yeah.
Some of the colleges now have got only 10 to 15 hours contact time with the students. Seriously. And some of that is taken up with English and maths, because they've come out of school without a sufficient level, so yeah, they've had to go back. So to me, that's one of the first things that need to be addressed, to give, you know, we've got a cracking bunch of lecturers out there that are really trying to do their job well, but they're just not being given the resources to do it with, and they're expected to turn these young chefs around in such a short period of time.
Is this a funding thing?
Well, I mean, as I think Steve said earlier, the problem is it's cheaper to do a degree course in a classroom where you don't need any facilities to actually build a kitchen and then supply goods every day for them to cook with. You know, it's a huge difference. And when the funding for the overhaul premises, and you've got to remember most of these colleges have multi facilities in them, cooking is one of the most expensive for them to actually facilitate and run.
Yeah.
So that's
Especially now it's even worse.
That's got to change. Now, there's obviously a lot of, there are three or four training establishments that work on in-house basis. Mm. So they bring in external verifiers. And I think the mixture of all of it is what we really do need. I mean, there's a place for them.
Yeah.
But having run a successful apprenticeship program for 25 years at the Royal Garden, I used to get the kids in when they were 16, come and spend a week with me during Easter. And I'd find that some of them at 16 were more than ready to come into the workplace.
Yeah.
But there were some that just weren't mature enough. And they were the ones that needed to go to full-time college, do a couple more years in education to get that confidence to be able to come out in the workplace. So we need this mixed learning, but they need to have more time. So if you get away from the colleges that are cash rich, that can give that additional support because they're rich, down to your localized ones that I'm now visiting quite regularly with the academy, that is where we need to really focus on trying to build a stronger team of chefs coming out.
Stephen, what's your...
Yeah, to be fair, I mean, it's interesting what Steve said there, that it is that thing of teaching time. So the whole idea of the content of the video that we try to create, and it's something that I got to understand, was this sort of flip learning process, i.e. you tell the student what you're going to teach them next week, you give them a resource, you then do the course that, or do the lecture the following week, which is reflective of what that resource is based around. And then you've also got that to come back to. So, you know, one of the things that was explained to me when I first started working with our, as I said, local college was, you know, these lectures last for an hour. So they take 20 minutes to get the individuals, you know, settled into the kitchen, into the game. They then take 20 minutes to clean down at the end of it. And you only therefore get 20 minutes of actual teaching
cooking,
time.
Yeah.
And to impart all that information in 20 minutes is impossible.
Yeah.
So I constantly use the thing of, you know, next week, for instance, we're going to do hollandaise. So rather than saying to the student, we're going to do hollandaise and leave them to then Google it, and find that they can find a thousand different ways to make a hollandaise sauce, but it's predominantly maybe an American with metric measurements and whatever. It's, there's a resource delivered by chef lecturer. You know, they can have a little bit of an experiment at home. The idea is that obviously the whole thing is available on your phone or on your laptop or your tablet, only because we know how the current generation gets all their information.
Yeah.
The idea then being that they've got that resource to do some homework before they arrive, inevitably probably on the bus or the train on their way into college the day they're having it. They do the lesson and then they've got the resource to use at the end of term. So if at the end of the term they're being judged on their hollandaise and they go back to chef. Yeah, they go back to the lecturer and say, Mr. Lecturer, I don't remember how to make it. He can refer them back to it as, right, this
and
is the source.
And the lecturer's kind of there. They're saying it's helpful, I guess, and obviously...
Absolutely. I mean, they're using it now in their training packs to actually use as a resource. So they're kind of listing it and telling them to go along and look at them because they've got such a limited time. So, if you took a flat fish, a filleting, they probably won't actually all get their own fish to fillet because of costs. So, and if they do, it's a place. They don't get anything like a lemon sole or a Dover sole or a halibut.
Yeah.
But on our training videos, we've actually got them fish to show them at the same time. So they can extend. The principle is the same, we know. Mm. But, seeing the different fish is another matter to them.
Yeah. And they may never have seen these fish.
Absolutely. Before. It's a picture in a book. Yeah. So from that point of view, it's there to support, taking nothing away from the lecturers. And when I, the first thing I do when I'm starting to talk, and I said, how many of you guys have missed a session? And up go pretty much everybody's hands. And I say, well, that's what we're here for. So if you've missed the hollandaise session, there it is online.
You can catch it up.
You can catch up.
So, I mean, it appears that young people have lost interest. I mean, we've kind of been talking about this, haven't we? But this lost interest in becoming chefs or waiting staff. Catering College has got fewer applications and job adverts, getting less people applying. And, and I know a lot of people in the hospitality sector are struggling to recruit staff. So kind of what, I know we've touched on this, but what's your kind of view? What can we do to get these people into colleges and,
I challenge a little bit. I think it's turning around. I think we've obviously, that word Brexit always comes into these conversations. And I remember from the Royal Gardens point of view, 60 cooks, probably 40 of them weren't UK.
Okay.
So they were transient. They'd come and do a couple of years. And especially in London, they wanted to work in London. They wanted to be there.
Get the experience.
So we've got this period of time where all of a sudden it's so difficult for them to come, especially if they're the lower ranks, that we've now got to get homegrown talent. And it's taking time for that to build. Mm. I definitely think we're getting there. I've talking to the admissions of some of these colleges, it's a bit of a mixed bag around the country, but some of them are overwhelmed with people.
Yeah.
You'll always get the fall off after the first few weeks when they realize it ain't so easy as they thought it was going to be. But, I am getting a positive feel that they're starting to come through. Mm. I just feel that they, from a governmental point of view, they need a little bit more support in their education, giving them more time so that, when I came out, I could really hold my own because I'd had a great education. I'd lots of time spent with me. I'd lots of practice, whereas nowadays they're not getting that.
No, I think they've kind of at school as well. I don't know, but I think a lot of schools are not doing cooking, are they, as much?
No. So trying to get cooking back onto the curriculum is so hard. We've talked about it in many facets from a health point of view. They talk about obesity in children. Well, if you're not teaching them how to eat healthily, how the hell can you blame them that, they're not, if their parents are both working, trying to keep a family together and the children aren't being taught about it at school, then, that's another problem. So, the government can do so much if they really just put some resources with it. But what, I don't want to say that there isn't young people coming in because there certainly is.
Okay.
There certainly is. And I think we've got to go through a period of rebuilding because of losing all them international.
Yeah. And hopefully we can get back some of those international with a bit more of a,
I'd just jump in there, Steve. I think you're totally right. I know everyone sort of says, the whole reason is because of Brexit. It's not part of that. That is an issue, but it's not. And I don't think and I say in inverted commas, that the UK got drunk on lots of young Europeans coming here, you know, wanting to learn English, i.e. just throw them into the hospitality industry. There was a certain amount of that. But yeah, those individuals wanted to travel. But a lot of those individuals wanted to travel because they wanted to develop their culinary skills, their hospitality skills and whatever.
Yeah, and their culture and things.
Exactly. And there is a, you know, there is a big difference here in the UK where, you know, as parents, and when I talk to, you know, other mates that I have and whatever, they never think of pushing their, or not pushing, but encouraging their children to go into hospitality because they just don't understand it. And I just look back on my experiences. As I said earlier, I've been lucky enough to travel the world, you know, eat in some amazing restaurants, meet some fantastic people, work on some incredible projects. And I don't have a culinary background. If you've got that, and you're, you know, that's explained to you as a 13, 14, 15 year old, you can travel the world, you know, on those skills and have a fantastic time.
Definitely.
Doing it. And it's
never be out of work.
And that was going to be my thing. You'll never not have a job in this industry. Exactly. Never not have a job.
And it leads in quite nicely to my next question, actually. So, and a recent, and I know we're touching on this, but this is the whole we're discussing today. So a recent UK survey highlighted some quite sort of disturbing facts that 55% of people think of hospitality more of a temporary job than a career option. And 44% of people think hospitality doesn't offer the career progression. I mean, these things aren't true, my view, because we're all in it and been in it for all old men. sorry.
Speak for yourself.
Stephen, what's your, how do we change this sort of narrative?
How do we, it is a change in the mentality of unfortunately parents. And I go back to probably the opening.
That's been our overarching thing today.
Yeah, just, you know, I say this and I can only talk about me personally and my experiences. And I'm sure Steve will have the same with his. But as I said, you know, Poppy, my daughter, she left school or she finished her A-levels during the whole pandemic period, you know, didn't want to go into further education. Conversations, need to go and get a job. And I really didn't mind what she went to do. She wanted to get a degree apprenticeship. So she wanted to be learning whilst being paid to learn. She went and got a job in inverted commas at our local pub, which was, you know, part of the opening in groups, who recognised in her very quickly a skill and put her in essence on a management development course. She's now what, 4 or 5 years into working. She's absolutely loving it. She's currently working at the Langham in London. And it's just amazing, the opportunities. And I'm
that's a progression, isn't it?
Yeah, and just as a 21-year-old lady now, it's just bloomed. And I say it's sort of tongue-in-cheek, but I'm almost sort of inclined to say, you know, every 16-year-old should be made to go into hospitality only because it gives them confidence in themselves. It gives them the ability to talk to people. Yep. You know, they can't just sit there and try and do everything on social media all the time. But, I mean, Steve, I'm sure you've had similar experiences.
But, you know, it's really interesting, the statistics you've got about people saying that working in hospitality is just a casual job. Mm-hmm. The amount of people that we've come across that's how they started.
Yeah.
You know, they get into this industry via doing a weekend, evening, Saturday job, and then they realise what a fantastic industry it is, and they just blossom from that. You know, you've just got all sides of it, whether they're doing the KPing in the kitchen and they see the chefs and they want to get involved with them. So many times, I mean, my number two when I left the Royal Garden Hotel started from Portugal, came over, he was my KP. I took him right through his apprenticeship. He only left me for 6 months because he thought he had to change. And he came back and he said, "Chef, can I come back?"
Wow.
And then we finished together in it. So I think it is a perception. It's not, yeah, it isn't the industry. Once you realize what you can do, and I think Steve's touched on it, you know, we are lucky enough to have traveled with it. You know, I didn't mention I was on the QE2 for 3 months and did a world cruise. You know, how do you get to go all the way around the world and get paid to do it?
That's another
thing.
I think you're right. I think it's a great industry, isn't it? I mean, I'm not just saying that. I mean, we have great fun at our networking events and it's a people industry. I mean, I remember pre-Brexit, I went to the Shard and I went to a solar panel industry event and oh my word, I was just like, I'm so glad I'm not selling solar panels. was boring in comparison to our sector.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I'm now going to see if there's a podcast on solar panels. Rad,
so, so, Stephen, you provide like an amazing resource for the hospitality sector. Is there more that the food service equipment sector could be doing to support, like, the work that, say, Steve Monkley is doing, or other colleges and that sort of thing? What us in the equipment sector be doing?
I think for me, it's just about, as an individual, wanting to get involved with your local college. I would encourage anyone who's listening to this, you know, find out who is the head of school, who are the lecturers, you know, try and get involved, try and, you know, I'm sure there's something we all can be doing to help, you know, even if it is just, you know, sponsoring the minibus to take these students on a day somewhere. Because, you know, the amount of conversation I have with different colleges, and again, I'm sure, you know, Steve will have this, that can't get students out to events because they haven't got the money in the budget to put them on a minibus. It's great. You know, there are suppliers out there. There are producers out there that want the students to come to the farm, the wherever, but they can't get the student there to, because there isn't £300 to hire a minibus for the day.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
But they'd probably pay for that anyway. So it's like to get them there.
Yeah. To me, I would actively encourage anyone, you know, because we have to think of this as a, you know, it is an industry-wide problem. Yeah, okay, we're at the equipment end of the market, as it were. You know, we're not necessarily talking every day to chefs about produce and traceability of elements and whatever. But we all have to think of this as a joint, you know, as I come back to my thing.
Joint venture,
really. Yeah, if we're not turning those youngsters out into the industry and we're not helping them progress and not helping them develop, you know, they're not going to be sitting here in 20, 30 years time giving podcasts saying, you know, what a great thing that did and got me started in this career.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's it. I mean, we all literally, people that have supported us through our careers are always the ones that we remember when we're in a position that we have a purchasing power. You know, I always remember from especially from suppliers' point of view, those that took the time to come into the kitchens and talk to you and engage with you rather than just going into the chef's office and you didn't even know who they were.
Yeah. And then those manufacturers stick with you. And then you kind of, humans being humans, you remember that and that. Yeah. It comes back, doesn't it?
I pick up your point, Rad. It is a people industry. Mm. It really is. And, you know, I know we all talk about, oh, you know, AI is coming and automation's coming and da-da. And I understand in certain sectors of the market and certain, you know, processes that will help. But at the end of the day, when you sit down around a table, you want to be served by somebody.
Exactly.
And you want and not to somebody.
Steve, I mean, what steps can employers do to sort of upskill their existing workforce? We touched on apprenticeships and things, but is there anything they can do extra?
I think, you know, a lot of employers now have got their academies, their different training establishments, their different training ways. You know, I'm constantly hearing of them wanting to train in-house. And I think the balance of all of it is what we need, because to upskill your existing workforce, to keep them, to maintain so they have a reason not to move on to the next guy. Because, you know, when we came back from the pandemic, you know, the salary scales in London just went ballistic. And, you know, I'm blown away now with how much the chefs are being paid, because there is a lack in the market. Yeah. So, you know, the ones that were good were getting an opportunity.
A good salary.
And I don't think that's bad. I think we've got to a stage now where we should be. But what then employers are doing is they're looking at, well, how are we going to keep that person? And they're looking at their working environment, their working hours, which has been really important because, you know, go back. Everybody knows that in the old days, chefs did 14 hours days. You know, you had a split shift, and if you were lucky, you got out in your split shift. If you weren't, you worked through. That's definitely changed immensely now. And the actual environment you're given to work in, the hours you're given to work in, is so much better. And I'm sure we can still do more. Yeah. But really, listening to all of them and seeing what they really want and understanding it. I made a point. We had yearly appraisals. I did 90% of the appraisals myself because it gave me the opportunity to talk to individuals and actually say, right, you've got me for half an hour. You talk about what you want. You tell me what you're missing. Is there anything I can do for you to make your life a better one while being here in the hotel? And that went a long, long way to actually keeping them. And, you know, to the day we left, I probably had such a small turnover of staff that that made me really proud. There was guys there that had been 20 to 25 years by my side.
Yeah. And it, in the end, it makes your life easier as well, doesn't it? Because you're not having to restart, get them back into culture, train, you know, all the rest of it. And you've got a loyal team around you. So there's benefits to upskilling them and keeping them. Mm. So just thinking about the Grand Cuisine Academy, I mean, how are you actually getting the chef lecturers engaged, you know, to take on this whole opportunity that you're offering?
Oh, that's been great fun, Rad. It's really interesting because wherever I go, I always ask the lecturer, would you like to be part of the video in going forward? And they instantly say yes. And then they think about it, think, oh my God, what I'm going to be on. And, and it's really funny. But the lovely thing about the Grand Cuisine platform is that it's not the same person teaching every day. You know, they're looking at different faces. You've got different ways of training. And these lecturers actually have great fun doing it. When we go down to video them, you know, you get over the initial couple of minutes of sort of nerves and shock. They forget that they're in front of a camera and they get on with it like they're doing a training session. We've got two of the lecturers from one of our North Arts colleges like to do it together. So they have a bit of banter between them.
Which, so a lot of your videos, they're not just you, really.
There's very few with just me. It's predominantly me getting other people to do it.
And then keeping interest fresh.
And then the funny thing is, when I go back to that college the next time, I make sure that all the kids know that their lecturers are on the videos and to make sure that they take a look at them once. and then they get a bit of stick from them afterwards. But the lovely thing is because the lecturer's teaching them day in, day out, they're doing it as per the textbook.
Yeah.
So we all like to think that when you come into this industry, there is a pretty good standard of the way you do something. You then go out, you work with many different chefs. They've all got their own ways. And then you learn
their own quirks. And
And different ways of doing it. But you've got everything is based on classical skills.
Right.
You know, you've got to have that good basic classical skills to do anything. And if you don't understand that, and you've just worked in somewhere where they're using all the modern techniques and everything, you know, or they never get a fish come in unless it's in a portion size or it's in a plastic bag, then they don't have it. This is all about basics.
This is getting
them really sort of ready for our industry, which is what a lot of chefs feel that education doesn't do.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay. So as is tradition in the series, the guest from each episode, the last guest, asks a question to the next guest. Now, I know you know who's coming, but don't tell the listeners. What question do you want to pose to the next guest? And I know you know him as well.
Yeah. I'd actually like to ask him, which was his favourite kitchen?
Okay. We'll see what he says next time. Well, a huge thank you to Steve Monkley and Stephen Hobbs for taking the time to be here today in London, and I hope you both enjoyed it.
It's been great. I loved it, right? Thank you.
And that concludes this episode of Kitchen Curiosity. I hope you've enjoyed the episode, and a big thank you to our listeners. The amount of people downloading and playing the podcast is growing week by week, and we're actually in the top 20% of podcasts in the UK now. If you've got any questions for future guests or any subjects you want me to cover, just pop me an email on radford@kitchencuriosity.co.uk, or you can message me on LinkedIn. And on the next episode, we have a gentleman who announced his ambition to be a chef at the age of 5. He's a greatly respected French chef who, I might add, is highly regarded Michelin star since 1990. He's a regular feature on Saturday Kitchen. He's worked all over the world with notable residencies in Singapore, Portugal, France and the UK. He was the executive head chef of the highly credited Vineyard in Newbury, and he's also been awarded Master Chef of the Year. He's joined by a lady who's a force to be reckoned with in a male-dominated sector. She's a highly experienced business development manager and renowned history of working in the food service manufacturing sector. She's dynamic, notable industry expert, and currently leads the food service division of a market-leading Australian brand. Click subscribe to follow us. Don't miss out on the next episode coming on the 20th of May. I've been your host, Radford Chancellor, and you've been listening to Kitchen Curiosity.